What an absolutely wonderful meal I had. I hope the rest of you did all right as well. That was just fabulous. And whenever I go to a potluck, I think back to a time when our son Bruce, our younger boy, who is 42, when he was 7, we were in a potluck at our church. And usually we tried to keep our kids with us. And Beverly and I were on different sides of the line and talking and to people around us and to each other. And we didn't realize that Bruce had gotten ahead of us. And that was just as we came to the end of the line, Bev says, "Where's Bruce?" And the other three children were with us. And then we finally saw him. He was already at the table that we'd selected. And he had this big beaming smile on. He had this big, "I've conquered" look. And we got to the table, and Bev looked at his plate, which was filled, and everything on the plate was a dessert. And she said, "Bruce, you didn't get any meat, you didn't get any vegetables." And he said, "I know." And then she said, "The only thing that's not a dessert is that potato dish." And he looked at that and he said, "Is that potatoes?" So he thought he had all desserts, but he'd missed on one thing. Anyway, it was so much fun. And this was so nice. So thank you all who prepared the food and presented it so well. I'm just so glad to be a part of it tonight. Now we're going to go to another familiar place in the Bible. We were in the book of Jonah, another book that's enormously well known, loved, studied, and it's impacted the lives of many, many people, is the little book of Ruth. The little book of Ruth is one of the most extraordinary books in the Bible for so many reasons. I told you Jonah was unusual. Well, so is the book of Ruth. I was a history major in college, and I remember one of my professors saying early on in my study that Western history is usually about important people, kings and great thinkers, and hardly ever do we have texts that describe the lives of ordinary people. And I remember that deeply impacted me, and years later, I was in a course in medieval history, and our professor had found a text for our course, one of the textbooks, and it was about a city dweller in France, and he was a craftsman, and he'd left a very lengthy diary that was written very, very well, and it talked about what daily life was like for an ordinary person. And he said, "This is such a rare thing because rarely in history do we read about ordinary people." And then another class in my senior year, world literature, I had a textbook, a very thick book, and it was an anthology of great literature from the world, Western world. And there were only two selections from the Bible, and one was the book of Job, and the other was the book of Ruth. And I remember that professor saying that this book stands out in biblical literature because it's not about kings and it's not about prophets and it's not even about men, but it's about a couple of ordinary women. And then think about that for a moment. Most of the Bible concerns the lives of men, and women are there, but some of them aren't even named. So we know Adam and Eve, and we know the wives of the patriarchs, Abraham and Sarah, and we have Isaac and Rebecca, good. And we have Jacob, four names. Can you name them? Jacob and, what did I hear? Rachel and Leah. And the two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. And then we have Joseph, and here's an extra credit answer, She was an Egyptian woman, Asenath. Well, that's an extra credit one. And Judah, who married a Canaanite woman, Bathshua, and then had relations unwittingly with his own daughter-in-law. Do you remember her name? Tamar. Good. So we know the names of some women, but then you have Noah and three sons. We know the names of the sons. We don't know the name of any one of those wives. We have Lot and his wife, Salty. So we wish that we knew more about women in the Bible. Then we come to this little book of Ruth, and it's so extraordinary because it's about ordinary people, and even more extraordinary, it centers on the lives of two women, and one of them is a foreign woman. So what an amazing, what an unusual book. And literary scholars view this as one of the finest literary pieces in all of the Bible. The structure, the writing, the scenes, the plot, the build-up to a point of tension, the denouement, the resolution. It is, one of my professors said, a perfect piece. And so we're glad to know that. And it's an extraordinary book. Now, last night we were in Exodus 34, and I mentioned the word chesed. Remember that word? Those of you who are here, that's H-E-S-E-D, and it's the word translated mercy, merciful kindness, lasting love. I like to render it loyal love. So in Exodus 34, God gives his own selfie. Remember that? He takes a picture of himself, says, "This is who I am." And he uses a variety of words to describe himself, of indescribable grace and unexpected patience, and he's filled with chesed ve'emet. Some years ago, 1982, I was at a conference in Chicago called the Council on Biblical Inerrancy, International Council Biblical Inerrancy, and it was a huge meeting. Over 2,000 scholars were there from all over the English-speaking world. And everyone there was there only because they believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, that the Bible is without error. And I presented a paper. I presented a response to a paper. And I was a seminar leader. But Bruce Waelke, who was my professor in my doctoral studies, he also had a very big role in that conference. And one day, I think it was Wednesday, he was going to be giving at 1 o'clock a response to a paper, and it's in a plenary session. So all 2,000 people would be there. And I asked him that morning, I said, "Would you care to have lunch together?" And he said, "Well, Ron, I'd love to have lunch together, but the problem is, I've got to be on time for the 1 o'clock meeting." And he said, "If you can promise me that we can get in and out of the restaurant, I'd love to do that with you." So I said, "Well, here's what I'll do. At the 11 o'clock meeting, I'll leave early, and I'll make a reservation, because the restaurant doesn't open until 11:30. But I'll make a reservation, and then I'll meet you at the door, and I'll bring you right into the restaurant, and we'll get served right away." So he said, "Well, that'll be great." So that's what I did. And we were the first people to be seated in the restaurant and given our menus, and were promptly ignored. And pretty soon the restaurant was filled, and no one had come to take our orders. All we had were these huge water glasses with ice on a very small table and our menus. That was it. Now, he's starting to get nervous because he said, I really have to be ready. Plus, the air conditioning is really cold in here, and I'm starting to get cold. I got to get coffee or soup or something. And there was a waitress about three tables over. So I picked up my menu, this big, stiff board menu, to go like this to try to get her attention. And so I'll do it with this arm. This arm's still recovering. So I went like this, and I knocked his huge water goblet with ice onto his lap. This is my mentor. And he goes, oh! I'll never forget that. And, oh, you know, if one could die and go away, that was the time. And now we're surrounded by wait staff bringing towels and napkins and new tablecloth. And can we bring you anything? And he says, maybe some hot soup. I'm thinking, this is just absolutely horrible. And he says, I'm going to have to eat pretty fast, Ron, because now I'm going to have to change my suit. This is horrible. So he changed his suit and came down, and I led him into the room where he's going to be giving this presentation. And I think what happened was that he was so unsettled by that startling water. Then when it came time for his presentation, he put his folder on the podium where he had his written notes. He opened it up, and he looked at them. And then he looked at me, and he closed the folder, and he took his glasses off, handkerchief, and he was wiping his glasses. And then he moved away from behind the pulpit to beside it, and he said, I've decided I can't do what I was going to do. And he said, it doesn't matter. You all have my lecture. The notes are in your folder. So instead of reading my lecture, I'm just going to talk to you. And the person who'd written the paper he was responding to was a man named Preuss from a Concordia seminary and a Lutheran scholar. And he was seated about where you're sitting, Henry, in this large room, very near center row aisle. And he looked at him in the eye, and Walkie did, and he says, Dr. Preuss, I want you to know, and you'll see in the written words, that I'm in full agreement and support with just about everything you said. The paper was on the attributes of God. But I wasn't going to say this, but I had a disturbing lunch, and I've decided to go off my notes. And then he looked at him again, and he said, Dr. Preuss, with all the excellencies of your paper, you missed the single most important word in the Bible about who God is. Now think about that. 2,000 scholars from all over the English-speaking world, and here's a man who's written this wonderful paper on the attributes of God, and you're told you've missed the most important word. So I looked at him, and he's a little stunned, not sure what to say, and probably wondering what the word was. And it's our word chesed that I mentioned last night. See, these talks, they all do come together. And this is the single most important word in all of Hebrew Bible on the nature of God. It's the word God uses to describe himself in his selfie. And we saw it in Jonah, in chapter 2 in the Psalm. Those who give consideration to other gods, they forget their own mercy. And the Hebrew word there is chesed. That is, why would anyone who has a relationship with living God, who is marked by chesed, loyal love, why would anyone turn away from God to something that doesn't even exist? And it's just a statement of incredulity in the Psalm of Jonah in chapter 2. And here is this wonderful word, H-E-S-E-D. But remember, the H is rough, so let's practice it again. Chesed. Try it again. Chesed. All right, I'm starting to hear it. You German speakers, this should be simple for you. Chesed. Try it again. Chesed, this wonderful word that gives you a sore throat if you say it too much. But this is the word. The word is so important that the King James translators could not agree on a single word translation because I can see them, I mean, I can imagine them around a table, and they have all of their lexical tools, and they have English tools as well as Greek tools and Hebrew tools and Latin tools and Syriac tools, and they're thinking, what word best renders this word? And they couldn't come up with one, so they came up with a number. And in our Bibles, we have words like mercy and goodness and loving mercy, and we have the word kindness and other translations because they felt no one word worked well enough. Walkie said that, in his view, loyal love is the best rendering, and that's what I've taught for years, because the word really combines two ideas. It combines love and loyalty, and they come together and they're bound inextricably. Whom God loves, he binds himself to forever. The security of the believer is not in the faithfulness of the woman or man of faith, but it's in the chesed, the loyal love of God, that God will not, cannot give up on one in whom he has this relationship. The nearest analogy, and it's a poor one, but the nearest analogy we have is the love of a mother for a child. And we have that in the term womb love that I mentioned yesterday in Exodus 34. This term compassion is from the term for womb. And if we think about a mother's love for a child, you know, there's just something warm and wonderful about seeing that. But as you know, the reality is there are some mothers who are not loving of their children. And every once in a while you hear about a mother who has killed a child or abandoned a child. And when you hear something like that, even if you've heard it more than once, there's an outrage every time, because it just seems like that's something that just could not happen, but unfortunately it does. In Isaiah, Isaiah is given the words of God to tell to Israel, you think I've forgotten you, and God says to them, I cannot. There are mothers who forget their children, but I am incapable of forgetting you. That's because of chesed. The love of God transcends even the love of a mother for her child. The word chesed is related to the word for stork. Have you ever wondered why? And well, years ago, when a child asks, Mommy, where did I come from? That the answer used to be, the stork brought you? It isn't that anymore. I was in line in a grocery store with our youngest granddaughter, Addie, who is now 9, but when she was 5, she pointed to a woman ahead of us in line who was obviously expecting a child, and she said, look, Grandpa Ron, Papa Ron, that woman's going to have a baby. And she said it pretty loud. And so the woman turned around and smiled at her, and she says, yes, honey, I'm going to have a baby. And she says, Papa Ron, do you know where babies come from? And I was fearful for where this is going. She says, they come out of the mommy's vagina. And I about died right there. This 5-year-old girl. What happened to storks? And the woman, she laughed so hard, I thought she was going to have the baby right there. But the idea of storks and babies comes from the observation of the ancients in the Near East as they looked at animal behavior. And they saw that owls have the appearance of wisdom, wise as an owl, that foxes can be kind of sly, that donkeys can be stubborn, and that the stork pair, in their experience and observation, were perhaps the most loyal animals to their young of anything they knew. And it's not just the mother stork, but they pair for life, we think, And I don't know, I haven't talked to a lot of divorced dorks, but but they pair for life, and their care for the young is legendary in the Old Testament world. Poets in the Bible and in other ancient literatures talk about the care of a stork for its young and contrast it with the ostrich. In the Bible, we read passages about the ostrich lays her egg in the sand by the sea and walks away forgetting what she's just done. But the stork pair build their nest in a strong bough of a powerful, strong tree, and then their care for their young is just proverbial. And the word for stork is chasda, and it's related to the word chesed. These words go together. And as they observed the stork, as they observed a mother, they thought about God. But every analogy falls short of the relationship God has with people. It's just these analogies are what we have to use as we think about it. So God is said in the scriptures that we've been in to be abounding in loyal love. This is his tenacious, determined love grasp that's for the good of his people. Psalm 23 ends in a wonderful line where it talks about he follows me all the days of my life. And the word to follow is actually a term of an animal on the hunt. It's a technical term of being viewed as prey, and there's a carnivore that's going to come down and get you. But that which is going to come down and get you is not an animal looking for lunch, but I'm being pursued by the goodness and mercy of God. A believer is to regard herself or himself as being followed by, enveloped by, grasped by, overcome by the loyal love of God. So we come to the book of Ruth, and this is the word that informs the whole book because it comes from Exodus 34, as so many things do. So we read that the book of Ruth takes place in the time of the judges, and I don't have to belabor that here, do I? All you need to know from the opening words, in the days when the judges were judging, that there was a famine, and you look at those words and that just puts you into a context immediately. And you know that the period of judges was a period of turmoil, of ungodliness, of rebellion. And you know the cycle that we read about in the book of Judges, that people would be at home with God, and then they would get lax, and they'd start following idols, and then God would bring judgment on them, and then they'd plead for forgiveness and ask for deliverance, and God would send a military leader that's called a shofet, a judge, and bring back to peace, and then the cycle is repeated, and the repeating of that cycle became a spiral. And so when I read in the book that the days when the judges were judging and there was a famine in the land, well, that's all we need to know. When God brought judgment on Israel for covenant infidelity, the first thing he might do would be to affect the rain cycles. Everything in Torah is about rain. I don't know if you know that, but rain is the key to it all. The people had been in Egypt, and in Egypt, you don't need rain because they have the Nile River. One day we were driving to Egypt from Israel in a bus, and all of a sudden I noticed some sprinkles, and it was sprinkling. And the driver swore in Arabic and turned on his windshield wipers, and they were scraping because the rubber was all bad, and the dust. He had kind of a mud wash. It was hard to see. And so he had to stop, and he had to get out a water bottle and wash off the windshield. And he's swearing in Arabic. And I said to him, isn't this wonderful? There's rain. And he swore again. And he says, we don't need it. We don't want it. I said, when's the last time you've ever turned on your windshield wipers? And he's a professional driver, full-time driver. He says, I think it's been 3 years. So you don't need rain in Egypt because Egypt has the Nile. And the Nile River not only brings an enormous volume of water, but in the annual inundation, it brings billions of particulates of new soil. So that on a carpet of sand, there's new soil that comes every year in the annual flooding of the Nile River. So the soil is never exhausted of its nutrients. It's new every year. And the soil is so rich in Egypt that in ancient times, the food from Egypt was regarded as the most nutritious of any place. Alexander insisted that his soldiers be fed only wheat from Egypt because he felt it was the best nutrition available. And that's because of this soil and the river. So Egypt is the gift of the river. No wonder they, not knowing God, worshiped the river as God. But in Israel, in Canaan, it's a different story. In Canaan, it's all rain. And rain comes in three periods. There's the former rain, and then there's the rain, and then there's the latter rain. I used to say there's the former rain and the latter rain. And in a PhD course, a seminar, a guy named Keith Schubert, I'll never forget this, raised his hand. And he says, now, Dr. Allen, you know that's not true. And I'd learned that if Keith Schubert says, you know, something's not right, you better listen to him. And I said, well, I thought it was true. He says, of course you did. Everyone says that. But you know that's wrong. And I said, I do? He says, yes, you know it's wrong. He says, what months have you been in Israel? And I thought, well, I guess over years I've been there just about every month except October. Then you know what you said is wrong. Have you been there in December? Of course. January? Of course. Think about it. And I did, and all of a sudden it hit me. God says in Deuteronomy 11 that I will give you rain, the former rain and the latter rain, and we've always understood that to be exegetical, that is, the rain comes in two periods. I'll give you the rain, former and latter. But really, it's I'll give you the rain, and that's the heavy rain of December, January. That's when 70% of the rainfall of the year comes in about a six-week period there. But then, in addition, I'll give you the former rain, and these are intermittent showers from mid-October to mid-November. Doesn't rain every day, but a little bit most days. And then the latter rain, intermittent showers of February, March, ending about March 15th. So God would give the heavy rains of December, January, the former rains before that, the latter rains after that. And basically, after the 15th of March, it doesn't rain again until about the 15th of October. So that's the pattern. Now, the rainfall combined with the snowfall on Mount Hermon causes the snowmelt, and the rainfall has, over millennia, caused passageways to be eroded in the sedimentary layers of hard limestone, soft limestone, and chalk. And these runways, if you will, of the aquifer appear over here as springs, and over here as ponds, and here is water that feeds the Jordan River, and here's water that winds its way to the ocean. And the rainfall in the wintertime finally makes its way all the way down to Beersheba in the Negev as it works its way through these ancient water passageways. And so it's everything is dependent on rain. So if God topples one of the rain periods, then there'll be famine. And that's what's happened here. If things get worse, he'll cause the neighbors of Israel to buffet their borders. And if things get really bad, then he'll send the people from the land. Now, in the book, we have a literary device that's a literary device of fullness and emptiness. The book is written exquisitely. All literary people comment on it. At the beginning of the book, we have a woman who's married and has two sons, and her name is Naomi. Her husband is Elkanah, her husband is Elimelech, and her sons are Mahlon and Chilion. We'll talk about those names. But it's a time of famine, emptiness, but she has fullness personally because she's married with sons, which was the goal of women in Bible times. When they go to Moab, and again, I'm not going verse by verse, you know the story. When they go to Moab, her husband dies and their sons die, and now she's completely empty. But she comes back to Bethlehem at a time of harvest. So it's a reversal of what she was. We call that inversion a chiasm. So she was full and empty, and now she's empty and full. And at the end of the book, she's full and full. So that's the literary device that holds the book together. And it's really extraordinary. So when the husband decided to leave Bethlehem, Judah, and go to a foreign country, the only way he could do that was to sell their ancestral land. And people didn't do that in Bible times. People didn't move. You'd only move if there was a disastrous calamity like warfare or horrible disease. No one moved in Bible times. But for him to move, it was because it was a purposeful move, and the only way he could manage would be to sell his property that was his to hold for his son and his son's son. But he sold it. And there's no money in Bible times, no coinage until the Persian period. So he sold it for pieces of silver and gold, and for perhaps tools, and for grain, and for livestock that could pull his wagon, for the wagon. And when they went to another country, then he is an alien who's coming to a new country. He has no rights in that land. So he has to buy land with the possessions that he brought with him. And when he bought that land, then that meant that he was now becoming a Moabite in everything that means. So he'd left God, and he'd left covenant, and he'd left Israel. He'd left the promises. He was on his own, and he bought land in Moab. Now then, he died, and then the sons died, and women don't inherit land in Moab. So there's a widow, and there are the widows of the two sons, but they're now without land because the land that was purchased reverts back to the original owner. So that's why when Naomi comes back, she's not only bereft of husband and sons, but literally of all her worldly goods and hope for the future, because she's lost the land that he bought in Moab, and the land that he had owned in Bethlehem was sold for the journey. So you see how awful it was for her. So this business about fullness and emptiness is really important. And they were just without anything. Now, at the end of the book, she becomes more full than most people can imagine. And again, I'm not going verse by verse. It's a familiar story. So I just want you to see what it's saying. Turn to chapter 4. Turn to chapter 4. And this is after the baby is born to Boaz and Ruth, the foreign woman from Moab. And when this baby is born, the women of the city have taken Ruth in, and they celebrate her. She's become a significant part of the community. It's a really beautiful thing. But you come down to verse 16 of our passage in chapter 4, and it says, "And Naomi took the child Vatekach Naomi et Hayeled. Naomi took the child. And then it says, Vatish Tehu, and she placed him, Bacheka, at her breast. Vatehilo Leomeret, and she became his nurse, Leomeret. And I look at that, and I say, is that even possible? So looking at whatever translation you have, if it's not the New King James, it will not say she put the baby at her breast. It'll say something like, she put the baby in her arms, she put the baby on her lap, but no other version, hardly, says she put the baby at her breast. Now, a few of you know that I've become a massage therapist. That's a crazy story. And a part of training to be a massage therapist, you learn anatomy. And after I finished my standard schooling for licensure in Texas, I took another course, 100 class hours, in advanced anatomy. So I've learned more anatomy than most massage therapists. And I say that to say, I know enough about anatomy to know the difference between one's lap and one's breasts. I mean, really, I can show you my certificates. I know this. But I'm picturing a group of scholars around a table, and they're doing Bible translation, and these are never kids. They're always older, and they're almost, until very recently, they're all men. Now there are women doing this too. But when the NIV was being done, they were all men, and they were all around a table, and they know Hebrew as well as I or better. They looked at this passage, and they saw the word, she put the child at her breast. And I can see these guys that are septuagenarians or older, and they're looking around the table, and they see there's one guy, Max, he's only in his 60s. And they say to Max, forgive us for asking, but is your wife about your age? Yes, yeah, why do you ask? Well, you're the youngest at the table. Can you imagine, can you picture your wife nursing a baby? And he laughs out loud. He says, no, I can't picture that at all. They say, we can't picture it either. So they look at this and they say, well, it didn't happen because it couldn't happen. So it didn't happen. So that's how they move the baby from the breast to the lap. You follow all that? Because that can't happen. So I was serving as a senior editor for the soon-to-be-published New King James Version of the Bible. There were three of us. And in addition to the books I was assigned, there were problems I was assigned to, and this is one of them. So I was teaching at Western Seminary in Portland, and a student had become a dear friend. His name is Richard Petty. And he was the chairman of the Department of OBGYN studies at the University Hospital in Portland, Oregon. And I called him up, and this is 1980. This is long before people had personal computers and we had access to the internet. In those days, there were these huge mainframe computers in universities and in some corporations, and people had time allotted to them. And I said, Dr. Petty, do you have any more time this month? He said, well, as a matter of fact, I do have a couple of hours that I haven't used. And you couldn't buy it. You barter for it, but you couldn't buy it. And I said, I have a question. I'm wondering if you could do a literature search for me on documented cases of women over the age of 70 in America who nursed babies. And he says, oh, that's a fascinating topic. I'm working with La Leche League to encourage women to breastfeed their babies, and I'll do that for you. So he called me a week later, and he printed out a big stack of papers, and they're all documenting. This isn't hearsay, isn't anecdotal, but these were actual stories of women in their 70s and 80s who nursed babies. And he said the common thing in these was a sense of tremendous bonding. between the woman and the baby. And he said, he showed me some were women who'd never even had a child of their own, but because of a tremendous sense of bonding with a baby, were able to nurse that baby. And these scholars around the table didn't know that, but I found it out. And so I look at this and I say, this is what happened. And then I started to think, well, we wouldn't even raise the question, except in modernity, women, they either nurse their baby or they get a milk substitute. But in earlier times, and even today, in some locations, there's a woman in a village called a wet nurse. And she's had a baby, and she still has milk. And a woman who doesn't have sufficient milk, she'll nurse that other child. And that's true in Africa. It's true in Asia. It's true in rural areas in America. I wouldn't be surprised in Canada. And the thing is, scholars don't know about these things because it's not parsing a word. It's asking about biology. So I look at this, and it's just absolutely astonishing that this woman, who is now in her 60s at least, is actually nursing her own grandson. And what this is the concept of fullness to the nth degree. It's not just that her life is full, even her breasts are full of milk that she can care for her own grandchild. And I think that's just wonderful. It's just so remarkable. Now, here are the Hebrew words, and you don't need to know them, but this is without dispute that the word means breast. And it's just translators didn't want to say that because they didn't think it was possible. And it is. Now, names in Bible narratives. When we come to names in the Bible, I've already played with a few names of prophets. The names in Bible times in Israel were all transparent because they were words of everyday usage, nouns and verbs that people know. In modern Canada and modern America, in the English language, we have so many feeder languages to English that when it comes to names, a lot of people don't know the meaning of their own name, and they can hardly be expected to know the names of others. I remember when I was a boy, I came home from the library, about 12, and I told my mom, I am so excited, you chose such a wonderful name for me. And I had looked it up in a book in the library, and Ronald comes from Reginald, and Reginald means mighty in power. And I said, you picked such a wonderful name for me, Mom, because I'm going to be a preacher, and I'll be what you wanted me to be, mighty in power. And she says, what are you talking about? I says, well, that's the meaning of Ronald. And she says, it is? She didn't know. I said, you didn't pick that name for me? She says, Ronnie, you know that we didn't know the Lord when you were born. We didn't think anything about that at all. Well, why'd you give me this wonderful name? Oh, she said, my favorite movie star was Ronald Coleman. You know, that's how I got the name. And it's just nice that it turned out to have a good meaning. But in Bible times, everyone knew the meaning of their name and everyone else's name because it's one language and they're common words. So when we come to Bible names, there's one group of names we call theophoric. There's the name of God in Hebrew letters, the four-letter name for God, Yahweh. And names of God, terms for deity, are paired with other words to give us what we call a theophoric name. And the name Elimelech is a splendid example of this. El means God, and Melech means king. So Elimelech means my God is king. And think about the significance of that name in the period of the judges. Remember the rubric of the book of Judges in those days? There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And apparently the parents of Elimelech were a godly couple, and as they looked at their little baby, they said, we pray that our child will grow up to be a man who will recognize that while there's not a human king, there is God who is king. So there's this wonderful affirmation of what the book of Judges is saying is lacking in ordinary people's lives. And then Elimelech leaves Bethlehem. He leaves Judah. He goes to this foreign country, Moab, which is on the southwest side of the Dead Sea, there in the lower right, where he has separated himself from everything that made him Jewish, that made him part of the covenant community. He's turned his back on God. He arranges marriages. Marriages were arranged in Bible times by parents. He arranges marriages with his sons, with Moabite women, and their children are going to be brought up as pagan Moabite people. God takes his life early because he's violated the meaning of his name. My God is king. And he says, I'll have none of it. So he turns away. Now, another type of name we have in the Bible are character quality names. And we have a number of these. And one of the most beautiful is the word Naomi. The Hebrew word Naham means to be pleasant. And Naomi, the E ending, means my. And I see her parents looking at a beautiful baby girl and saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if when our daughter is an adult woman, that people would look at her and they would say, she represents the pleasantness of God, and that God looks down on her and he says, Naomi, my pleasantness, this wonderful name. And some of you think maybe I'm stretching things, but believe me, I'm not. Because when she comes back from Moab and the women she hasn't seen for 10 years look at her and they ask each other, could this be Naomi? She yells at them. She says, stop calling me Naomi. It's a jussive, immediate cessation. Stop calling me that name. Call me now Mara. Mara means bitter. I'm embittered by God because God has taken my husband, and he's taken my sons, and he's taken my land, and I don't have anything except this tag-along foreign woman. I will never be pleasant again if you call me anything. You call me that old bitter woman. See, names have meaning, and the meaning is known by all. Now, there's another type of name that have to do with circumstances and birth. When a child is born, if the child is healthy, that's the most exciting thing in life normally. But what if when the child is born, the midwife, who is on her knees between the spread legs of the birth mother, and two other midwives are supporting her upper body, as she's on a three-legged stool very near the floor. That's how it was done. And one of the midwives see the baby presented. There's crowning and then the delivery. And one of the midwives looked at this baby and said, Machlon, which means the child is not going to survive. But it does. But the child is sickly. And he's called Machlon, failing. What an awful name. And two or three years later, his brother's born, maybe the same midwife. Kilion. He's dying too. What awful names. Sickly, failing, it's time for dinner. Imagine that, growing up with those awful names. And in Moab, they died as early adults, after marriage, but before fathering children. So those are circumstance of birth names. Some names are descriptive of physical attributes. The name of one of the Moabite women is Orpah. Now, this is Moabite, but that doesn't matter. Moabite and Hebrew are just dialects of the same language. It means neck. And it's a term describing physical beauty. I know two women, but I know of others, in Israel whose name is Orpah. It's a beautiful name, She of the Beautiful Neck. It's a term of endearment. And there's one person internationally known whose name was misspelled. And that's how we got Oprah. It's the same name, but a letter was transposed. We're not sure by whom. Then we have names that are character qualities, and this is the one that you just feel the fixes in. The word Ruth, of all things, Ruth means friendship, and it's just too pat. And that's why some dismiss the book as fiction. But it has to be historical for a Bible believer, because the book of Ruth feeds into the story of David, which feeds into the story of Jesus. So how do these names come about that work so well? My view is it's divine providence, that God directed the parents of these people to give them names that would play this significant role in this book. Now there's the husband for Ruth. His name is Boaz. And again, this name is just too good. It's swift strength. And he's a person who's able to do what needs to be done. And so he has the strength to do that, strength of character, as well as financial stability and godliness. The baby that is born, the name for the baby is Oved, he who serves. So these names are just wondrous. But then there's one name that is omitted. And because all these names are so good, so fitting, that makes this all the more remarkable. Turn to chapter 4. Now again, I'm assuming you know the story, that Boaz has fallen in love with this foreign woman, Ruth, and there's the issue of the nearer relative, and the nearer relative has the right of first refusal. And Boaz is one of the elders of the city, and he sits in the city gate, and that's a position of leadership of the city. It's like the city council, and they adjudicate issues that come before them. And one day, the city council, the town elders, are meeting, and Boaz may be the leader, and this man who's the nearer relative is walking by. So we read in chapter 4, the beginning of the chapter, that Boaz has gone up to the gate and he's sitting there. And behold, the Goel, the nearer relative, was passing by. So Boaz calls out to him and he says his name, come and sit here, because it's time that we work this out officially. So he would have said his name in a book where names are so important. But you know what? His name is omitted from the text. Instead of his name, we have a funny Hebrew expression. Come here, Poloni Almoni. And you're supposed to laugh at that. Poloni Almoni. You know, full of baloney. I don't know. Poloni Almoni, it's Hebrew for what's his face? In a book where every character's name contributes to the story, and the guy who might mess everything up in the story, he's called to appear before the city council, and his name is deliberately left out, and instead there's this funny phrase, Poloni Almoni. And it turns out that Torah says if a man refuses to do the rites of family protector, that his name must be forgotten in Israel. So he's the one with the deliberately forgotten name. Isn't that amazing? This story is rich on so many levels. It's just terrific. Now, there are two key ideas in Ruth that are part of the culture of the time. And one is the word goel. And you've probably heard that word before. It's the word translated redeemer or kinsman redeemer. The word ga'al means to purchase back, to redeem. Think of the story of Hosea, who married this woman, this unfaithful woman, Gomer. And they're together for a while, and the first child we know is theirs. The second and third child she gives birth to, but Hosea never knew who the father was. And they didn't have paternity tests. and she's not faithful to him. So he may or may not have been the father of childs 2 and 3. But then come the parting of the ways, and she goes back to the temple where she'd been before and is now an employee of a Canaanite pagan temple where she's a cultic prostitute. And what could be worse than that? But Hosea loved her so much that he went and bought her back. And again, there's no money in Bible times until the Persian Empire. And so he brings silver and gold, but he doesn't have enough. So he brings grain to pay the full deal so that he can buy her back, his own wife, so that she can be with him again. And that's the idea of buying back. That's a redeemer. So the redeemer is someone who protects the family rights. And in the Bible, if a family comes into difficulty, then someone in the family has to stand up for the impoverished, for the maimed, for the hurt, and to work out a way that things will work. And one of the great terms for God in the book of Isaiah is he is the Goel of Israel. And this is one passage in Isaiah 41, where God takes great joy in calling himself Israel's Redeemer. And I'm going to skip the next. There are several passages in Isaiah where that's used. God is the kinsman redeemer. And Boaz is a Goel, but he's not the nearest relative. And the nearest relative has right of first refusal. So here's what happened at the city gate. Boaz, with the elders, look at this man, Poloni Almoni, and they say, now, we've been talking about this for some time, and it's time now to come to an adjudication, come to a judicial decision. Are you able, are you ready, have you determined to buy back the land that was sold? So remember the story? Elimelech had sold his land, bought a farm in Moab, lost that when he died, that is, his wife lost it. So now she's back as a widow, and there needs to be the repurchase of that land. So this nearer kinsman is trying to figure out how he can do it. And he's probably talking about futures of his crops and hawking of tools and shared labor. And he says, we've decided that we can do that. We will buy back the land. And then Boaz hits him with the second shoe. And you know, it's not just Naomi, but it's now Ruth. And you need to marry Ruth. And he says, da what? And he probably was thinking that since Ruth is a foreign woman, she wouldn't come under the concept of levirate marriage. And levirate marriage is where if a man dies and leaves a young widow, then it's the responsibility of his brother to marry the widow for two reasons. One is to secure a future for the dead husband through a child that would be born in the second marriage, which would have a double heritage. There's the genetic parentage from the new husband, but there's the assumed descent from the dead man who didn't actually father the child. And this holds the land and the family. But it also protects the widow. This is awful to say, but in Bible times, it's not the teaching of the Bible, not the teaching of God, but the practice of peoples in all the ancient Near East, that a widow, this is awful to say, was considered used merchandise. Who's going to marry a widow? That's why Ruth and Orpah were told by Naomi, while still in Moab, go back to your fathers. But there's a question, would their fathers take them back? This is an Asian book, and part of Asian culture is shame. And a man whose daughter was so unfortunate to become a widow, her widowhood brings shame to her father. And will the father take her back? No one knows. Will a brother take her in? No one knows. To be a widow in the ancient Near East, not just Israel, but all the surrounding countries, was a real tragedy. So probably this Poloni Almoni had figured, well, since she's a foreign woman, this law won't apply. But it does, because there's a pocket of godly people in Bethlehem, and Boaz is the leader, and these are people that want things to be done right, and someone has to marry and care for Ruth, this Moabite widow. And he says, I can't do that. And then we all sigh relief. Oh, good. But since he doesn't do it, what he's supposed to do, he has to take off his sandals and as a symbol that he's lost the right to walk on that land. And she'd spit in his eye. I don't think she had to do that this time, because we're just so glad that that it happened the way it did. And but his name is forgotten, and that's why we have the man with the forgotten name. So these two concepts, the Goel, the protector family rights, and the Leverite, that's lever is a Latin word meaning brother-in-law, these two things are floating around in the book of Ruth, and it makes this so fascinating. Now, here's the passage in Deuteronomy 25. That talks about how these things ordinarily would work. It's a part of Torah. So in this particular case, the relationships are not exactly what Deuteronomy presents. It's not a brother. In this case, it's a relative, a male relative. But this is the way it has to work. So there it is. And when it works, it's wonderful. Now, here's 25, people working as, living as family together. And here's what the gate structures look like. I told you that he's an elder, Boaz is an elder of the city. The massive structures are by the wooden gates, huge towers. What's going? I'm going, thank you. So massive towers are by the city gates. And the gates themselves, there's not one gate, there are three, one behind another, and your life is going before you. There it is. And the idea is that if the outside gate is breached, that there's another gate behind, and between the two gates are crammed as many soldiers as they can fit in there, and they're going to fight to the death to protect the second gate. And between the second gate and the third gate, similar deal. And in order to get a lot of people, there are recesses on each side of each of these gate structures. In times of peace, there are benches, as you see in the one picture, where the elders can sit and sit in adjudication. So we teach these things to our children, as you do. And when our boys, who are 8 years apart, were 16 and 8 respectively, Christmas, our son Craig had a wonderful girlfriend. We all loved her. Her name was Jennifer. And the day before Christmas Eve, her mother drove her to our house, and they exchanged presents, and they were seated a respectable few inches apart on the living room couch, and all very embarrassed at all the attention on them. And the 8-year-old brother, Bruce, squeegeed his little bottom between his 16-year-old brother, Craig, and the 16-year-old girlfriend, Jennifer, and he put his arms around both of them, and he said, "This is really nice." And Craig is steaming. You know, his brother has come between him and his girlfriend, and Bruce loves to see me laugh, and he knew he was setting me up for this. And he said, "Craig, how are you feeling?" And Craig says, "Well, I'm really angry." And he says, "Now, I don't mean that. Are you sick?" "What do you mean, am I sick?" I'm mad at you. And he says, no, I just wonder if you're feeling okay, if you're getting sick. Because you know what Dad says is, if you die, I get Jennifer. Well, I'd never said that, but but that's how he'd put it together. That was so much fun. Now, the most beautiful passage in the book of Ruth, and one of the most beautiful in the Bible, are the words that describe her endearment, Ruth's endearment to her mother-in-law in chapter 1. And I just absolutely love these words. This painting was done by one of my students of her sister and their mother, representing Ruth and Naomi and her cleaving to her. So I'm in chapter 1, and I'm looking at verse 16. And I read that Ruth said, stop pleading with me to forsake you, to return from following after you. This is the words of Ruth to Naomi. And then she says, ki el asher telechi elech. For into whatever place you may ever happen to go, I will go. And then it says, uva asher telini alin. And in whatever place you may happen to die, I will die. Amech ami, your people, my people, velohayech elohai, your God, my God. And here is her testimony of saving faith. This is friendship evangelism. Through Ruth, even in Ruth's growing bitterness, Ruth had learned about true God, and her attachment to her mother-in-law is an attachment of chesed, of loyal love. And she says, in whatever place you may happen to go, I will go. Whatever place you may happen to stay, to live, I will live. Your people, my people, your God, my God. Verse 17, Ba'asher tamuti amut. In whatever place you may happen to die, I will die. That is, she's not going to stay with her mother-in-law until her mother-in-law dies and then go back home. No, she's going to stay wherever her mother-in-law died, and she'll remain there for the rest of her life. And she says, Vasham ekaber, and there I will be buried. And then she gives the most powerful formal oath that we have in the Bible. Thus may Yahweh do to me, and thus may increase, if anything but death were ever to be a division between me and you. What a remarkable thing. This is among the most beautiful expressions of affection and love and care in all of the Bible. And it's so wonderful, and it's expressed by a woman to a woman. And it's just so moving. And then, so this is an expression of chesed, of loyal love. And then Boaz remarks to Ruth when he invites her to share a midday meal while she's threshing in his field. And he said, the whole town is aware of how you've behaved and how you've shown this loyal love. And your loyal love is just overwhelming. And you've come to God as one comes to God for protection. And it's like a chick seeking refuge under its mother's wings. Now, I grew up in Los Angeles, and we didn't have chickens when I was a boy. Some of you may have chickens, but we didn't. When we moved to Oregon so I could teach at Western, I told Bev, we have to go to Israel a lot, and we have to buy a hobby farm if I'm going to teach Hebrew, because that'll help me be a Hebrew teacher. She bought that, and we bought the farm, and everything I learned was really brand new, as I didn't know anything. And one day I was out planting trees, fruit trees, a dozen fruit trees. By the way, that's too many fruit trees. But who knew? So I'm digging 12 holes, and my neighbor, who was born for the country, I mean, he has this Western look. If Marlboro cigarettes were still sold, he could still be the model for their ads. And he has this cowboy hat, and he has jeans that fit, and this lean look, and his skin is all mottled by the sun. He's just perfect, and he's roaring with laughter as he's leaning on a fence post. He's going, ho, ho, ho. That's Lloyd roaring with laughter. And I said, Lloyd, what's so funny? He said, you are. I said, really? He says, I'm just looking at you. Everything you have on looks like it's brand new. And it's true. I'd just gone to Sears, and I'd bought work pants and a work shirt and work boots. Everything was brand new. He said, you know, when you dig holes, you wear old clothes. I says, my old clothes are old suits. I don't have work clothes. And he just thought that was so funny, and I started laughing too, but that's the way it was. So we would get chickens, and we had rabbits and goats, and we had everything. But I'd get chickens flown from Missouri to Oregon, three-day-old chicks. And I'd get meat birds, 75 of them. And then I'd get, every 2 years, a dozen layers, Rhode Island Reds. And for fun, three Araucanas. They're from Chile. And their eggs, shells, are pastel, pink, blue, or green. That's true. And you know that. Okay, so I'm not lying right now. Okay, Araucanas. So one morning I was out feeding the chickens before leaving for seminary, 6 in the morning, and I noticed there were only 2 Araucanas. And I thought, oh, Bev told me that one of the hens was starting to fly, and I neglected to clip her wing. You clip the long feathers on one wing and the tail dive, they can't really fly. So I learned the expression, she'd flown the coop. And I was sick about it because I figured the dogs would kill her. So I ran into the house, I got the special shears, and I cut the other 2 wings on one side, or the other 2 birds. And I was just kind of kicking myself as I drove to school. Weeks went by. It's April. It's a Friday. It's 4 o'clock. And I was starting a Bible conference at Grace Bible Church in downtown Portland at 5. With a dinner. And Bev called me. She says, Ron, I know you have to leave for the church, but I wish you were here. The dogs are barking, and we looked out. That hen you thought was probably killed is strutting across the front lawn, and behind her are 13 chicks. We later found where she found a safe place and had laid and hatched these eggs. And the 13, and it's like a Discovery movie or something, a Disney film. And I said, well, now you have to get the chicks, or the dogs will get them. And I said, with my marriage hanging on a slim thread, could you have the kids put the chicks in the utility room, because it'll be cold tonight. And tomorrow, Saturday, I promise I'll take care of things. So Saturday morning, I went out with our 2 older children, and we scrubbed down the brooding area in our 4-stall barn, put down new litter, and then we put these 13 chicks there. And instead of turning on the brooding light, I thought, she's hatched them, let her brood them. So we went to the hen pen, and each of us picked up one of these Araucanas. And I set mine down, and she just started scratching in the litter, oblivious of the chicks. So I lifted mine up, and my daughter put hers down, same thing. Son put his down. And it happened so fast, we hardly saw it. This hen goes like this, and all those chicks were under her wings. And she's saying, you know, don't you ever touch my chicks again. And I'd never seen that before, the hiding under the wings of the mother. And I told my class that the next Monday, my Hebrew class. And John Van Ploeg, I still remember his name, said, you call this number, I'm going to call him today. My father-in-law has a story that you'll appreciate. So I called his father-in-law, retired Baptist preacher in Minnesota, and he had rural ministries, and he said, John told me about your story. He said, in my last pastorate, in October, there was a dairy farmer in our church who called. His barn had burned to the ground, and this was a disaster. He'd had hay and 2 green, and spontaneous combustion, and the fire destroyed the barn. And so this was a catastrophe. He had insurance on the barn, but they couldn't rebuild it till spring. It's Minnesota. And so he's had his men clear off the apron, and he's had to take his cattle, his dairy cows, and board them out. And he was so stressed out. So the pastor came for the call, and this guy in heavy coat, and it was snowing and cold, and he was kicking the last embers that were still on the apron where the barn had been, and this thunk, and he's just muttering, and thunk, and then thud, a different sound, and then he said, "Oh, that's not wood. That's my barn hen." And he had just barely kicked the barn hen dead off the apron, and there were three chicks in a tight circle alive. That mother hen literally had covered those chicks with her wings and roasted to death to protect them. Isn't that something? And that's the image of coming under the wings of God, and that's loyal love. So the picture of loyal love in the book of Ruth is just enormous. And Ruth's loyal love is so impressive that the whole town can't do anything but talk about it. And here's the big problem. Deuteronomy 23 says that a person from Moab can never become a full citizen of Israel, but his descendants, 10 generations later, might become a part of the community. Ruth becomes a part of the community in her lifetime. And she's celebrated by godly people. And how does that work? And it turns out that's the theology of the book of Ruth. The theology of the book of Ruth is this. Torah is really important. The law of God is really important. And if a man so defies God as Elimelech did, sticking, as it were, a stick in the eye of God, then that man's life may be shortened. And that's what happened to Elimelech. But if a person has shown such resolve to honor God and exemplify loyal love, chesed, God may set aside for that person the strictures of Torah, because Torah can be really strong and really firm, but Torah can also be sometimes more elastic, because God looks at the heart and he evaluates the situation. And for Elimelech, it was a serious offense. For Ruth, she comes in under Torah because of God's great mercy. So the book of Ruth, in addition to being a beautiful story and a portrait of God's love and salvation, is also an explanation of how the law was to be used. Firm, but sometimes elastic, if the conditions of the person warrant that. So at the end of the book, we have a woman who's gone through a lot in her life, Naomi. And at the end of the book, she is glorifying God. She loves her daughter-in-law. She loves her new son-in-law. Her daughter-in-law, her new son-in-law. And she's just ecstatic about the baby that is her future. And the book of Ruth is a book of love. So here's my wife, you haven't seen her yet, surrounded by some of our grandchildren. And she didn't nurse them, by the way. But she loves them dearly, as grandmothers must. Father, thank you for the opportunity you've given me to share from this remarkable book and the book of Jonah. Such disparate books, but they both talk about your great grace, and we're the beneficiaries of your grace, even as these people in olden times. Your grace has never been greater than it was in the death and the resurrection of Jesus for us, in honor to yourself and with the effects in our lives. And we're so grateful that you are the God who loves your own with chesed, with loyal love. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.